This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Once in a while, as an interviewer, I get involved in a conversation that I just have to give up trying to shape and instead sit back and enjoy. The following is one of those conversations. About 2 minutes into it, I decided to turn Dr. Doug Day and his guitar loose to ramble on about the sociological, anthropological, and historical stew of music, stories, food, dance, and general everyday stuff that constitutes his chosen field of study, folklore. Ladies and gentlemen, the rambling folklorist, Doug Day.
Okay, this is Mississippi John Hurt's song Candyman, which is also sort of a stand, even though he was from Mississippi. Mississippi John Hurt basically played Piedmont style, finger picking, alternating bass. This is one guitar. I've got an alternating bass and a syncopated melody on the top. That style of playing, one of the best practitioners of the Piedmont blues was John Jackson, who, most people know who John Jackson was. I hope most Virginians should know. They should be teaching it in all the public schools. But John was a National Heritage Award winner from the National Endowment for the Arts, and he was discovered by UVA folklore professor Chuck Perdue back in the 60s. When he was a young man in his 50s, John was. And Chuck discovered him playing in a gas station near Fairfax and had a guitar and with him. And Chuck said, can you play anything on that? And he starts playing. I play a little bit, he said, you know, and he really had not been playing for a long time because apparently back in when he was in his 30s, I guess, there was a house party he was playing at, and somebody came in with a gun and started shooting, and there was a broken bottle and there was a knife somewhere involved, and John managed to grab his trusty Gibson J45, which is what this is. It's not John's, but and jump out the window, and he never played another house party like that again. But he got through the Purdue's playing in coffee houses in D.C. and met John Hurt, Mississippi John Hurt, who he'd heard growing up on the 78s. Now, this the whole Eastern style of finger-picking guitar, which is real prominent in Virginia and North Carolina, down into South Carolina. It's called East Coast style blues. Sometimes people call it the Piedmont blues, though it really reaches way farther than just the Piedmont, of course, into the Tidewater and the mountain sections too of the upland South. But it's a little different from the kind of blues. It's a different history. It's a little different from the blues they play down in Mississippi, for example, or Louisiana or Texas, which has got a much more rhythmic, heavy. Thumpy on the bass.
And,
yeah, well, it's more African is really what it is. And the black music traditions on the East Coast, well, for one, now we think that there were different African ethnic groups that were transported to the eastern, the mid-Atlantic, then were sold in the deep south. It came from different parts of Africa, so they brought different musical traditions with them. And of course, on the East Coast, they were here from the 1600s, not the 1700s or 1800s. I think some of the oldest folk music traditions in America are in Virginia on the Eastern Shore, in Virginia and Maryland. There's a lot of traditional Black religious music. The gospel singing goes back generations and generations and generations in single families on the Eastern Shore. So there's not as much continuity in the Deep South as there is here. But people were playing fiddle and banjo primarily in the early years of colonization. Blacks brought the banjo. We have paintings of banjos in Virginia in the 1700s being played by Blacks to fiddle accompaniment. The guitar didn't come in until late 19th century or so, and it was a woman's parlor instrument. But a lot of the early tunings for the guitar are still around in folk tradition. I've interviewed musicians here in Virginia who, straight out of the folk tradition, the oral tradition, who are playing primarily in open tunings, open chord tunings, that they learned from their parents.
What does that mean?
Well, here, I'll show you. Here's the regular tuning on a guitar. I'm not promising that's concert pitch, but that's E, A, D, E, A, D, G, B, E. And an open tuning like this one. Hawaiians call this slack key, because you slacken the keys to get to all the traditional Hawaiian tunings. There's all this cross-pollination between Hawaiian and white and African musics, particularly in the early years of the 20th century. Okay, so now you've got an open chord. That's open D tuning.
What does open mean?
Well, it just means that without it putting any fingers on the guitar. Those are open strings, every one of them. D, A, D, F sharp, A, D. So it's the D triad. And this was real handy when playing. This is actually an African technique.
What's this?
This is
talk about what you're doing. Well, I can see it.
Yeah, sure. It's called bottleneck style, and I'm using a metal tube. And when I first started doing this 35 years ago, nobody had heard of it. But now you hear it everywhere in commercials and everything. But people like John Jackson, who grew up playing in his own community in the folk tradition, here in Virginia, they probably the most common tune is John Henry. And this is sort of how John would play it. Alternating bass and then the melody on the top. And using a slide on a string like that first became popularized in America because of the Hawaiian music craze. I'll tell you the whole history. Joseph Kukuku at the King Kamehameha School for Boys in Honolulu in 1889, this is what he claimed, invented slide guitar by using a steel comb in his shop class to glide along the strings and give you that Hawaiian sound. And it became immediately very popular and a big fad all over the world. I mean, there were British and Australian Hawaiian bands, not a single Hawaiian in any of them, of course, mostly white folks. And they would tour in great groups. There were all-women Hawaiian guitar bands with, you know, six different national steel guitars, everybody playing lap style. And Hawaiian troops or Hawaiian-esque troops would play with medicine shows and circuses. Oh, I remember there's an interview with a musician from Crozet named Billy Vest. He was a early Columbia recording artist. He was in the studio the same time as Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. He was basically a Jimmy Rogers imitator when he was a teenager, but managed to get on record. But there's a great interview with him, which we have at the Albemarle County Historical Society and in the Virginia Folklore Society archives, where he talks about running away from home from Crozet with his brother, and they're going to be famous. And he jumps the train in Crozet and makes it all the way to the big city of Winchester, where they get off the train and join a circus. They go to a circus, and there are all these crowds, and so he takes out his guitar and starts yodeling like Jimmy Rogers. And the circus owner realizes he's got a bigger crowd on the outside than he's got on the inside. So he hires Billy Vest, the strolling yodeler. That was his musical name.
Although this weary world I wander, my thoughts alone will be of you. In memory I will see you forever. I love you better than you knew. Do you live? Do you live?
So he's standing outside the tent, you know, come on in. And eventually he gets billed as Little Jimmy Rogers or Jimmy Rogers Jr. You know, it's like Brownie McGee being Blind Boy Fuller number two. You know, he talks about the Hawaiian troupe that was in the circus, and they were the headline act. And it was somebody in his Royal Hawaiians, you know. And I'm sure not a Hawaiian in the group, but that was the big craze. So all over the country, these touring Hawaiian groups spread the idea of slide guitar. They must have encountered somewhere down in the deep south a pre-existing or coexisting slide tradition. W.C. Handy, the first mention of the blues, he said he first heard the blues in Tutwiler, Mississippi, and I've been there, by God, where the Southern crosses the Yellow Dog. The Yellow Dog was a small gauge railroad track, and the Southern crossed it. In Tutwiler, there's nothing in Tutwiler now, believe me, but I've been on the train tracks, and I've stood where W.C. Handy first heard the blues with a bottleneck. And there is an African tradition of using bone or shell on stringed instruments, which, oddly enough, resemble banjos, and imitating the voice. That's the best thing you can do if somebody says, you can really make that thing talk. That is the best compliment you can get in the blues. Like that.
Back after a break for further conversation with folklorist Doug Day. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Back before the break, I was talking with Charlottesville's Doug Day, or Douglas Turner Day, as he's known professionally, because, he says, there are so many other Doug Days. We heard Doug play some music and riff about the blues. He's got a suitcase of stories and tells them delightfully, if not necessarily linearly. So I've decided to begin this segment with the part of our conversation in which Doug Day explains how he got interested in folklore in the first place.
I discovered as a small child, I guess, folklore. I didn't realize it was a discipline until I met Chuck Perdue, the late Chuck Perdue. He was my professor at UVA when I went to college, but I knew him before then because my dad taught in the English department at UVA. And Chuck came in, I guess it was 72. I think he was fresh out of, or just finished his dissertation. He went to graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania, their folklore department they had then. And he got a joint tenured position in the English and anthropology departments. So he had a joint appointment, which was really unusual. Because they couldn't figure out what to do with him in either place, because folklore is kind of in between. And that happens a lot to folklorists. I was in the first graduating class at Tandem in 73, and I think in 72.
That's Tandem School in Charlottesville.
It's now the Tandem Friends School. We were all friendly in those days, but it was just the Tandem School. I graduated in 73. So I think it was 71 or 72. Chuck and his wife, Nan Perdue, who they were always joined at the hip. I mean, they worked together all the time. They did everything together their entire lives. She's still alive, and I'd like to say hello to her here in Madison County. But they brought Mike Seeger, who was then married to Alice Gerard, and John Jackson, and Ralph Stanley, and the we all know who Ralph Stanley is. We don't have to mention Ralph, do we? Ralph. He was still Mr. Ralph in those days. Bessie Jones, who was from the South Carolina Sea Islands and was famous for children's games. She and Bess Lomax Hawes, who was, I think at that point, about to become the first director of the folk arts program at the National Endowment for the Arts. Bess had written with Bessie Jones a book on South Carolina children's games and play party songs and that sort of thing. And Bessie Jones made sort of a career on the folk circuit singing, and it was she was wonderful. And some young man, I don't remember who, from Galax, who was a flatfoot dancer. Anyway, Mike Seeger brought all these folks into Tandem. They were playing a concert at Lane High that night, and I had never seen anybody actually finger pick a guitar before.
No, how come they all tripped over to Tandem? Do you know?
It's just a day thing, and I don't know what the connection was.
Somebody asked them to. Yeah.
Somebody asked them. They came by, and we all sat on the floor in the living room.
All 13 of the Tandem.
Yeah. Well, it was the whole school, so there were probably 40 of us, right?
Okay.
At that point, and you know, I'd been listening to Mississippi John Hurt and Lead Belly and that kind of stuff because my parents had folk records. You know, they were into Dylan and Joan Baez and the Kingston Trio and that kind of stuff. And I really liked the sound of fingerpick guitar because you could be a whole band just by yourself. And I was teaching myself that alternating bass, but the first time I ever saw anybody do it was John Jackson playing old Mississippi John Hurt songs that he'd learned in the 30s, back in the 30s.
Wow.
When he was coming up, and Blind Blake, and there were race records back in those days. There was a separate marketing category for the popular records, and the race records that were popular in the 20s, or 30s, and 40s were what comprised John's repertoire. Of course, he listened to white country music all the time, too. But he played in that traditional Blind Boy Fuller. Blind Boy Fuller was probably the biggest name in the Piedmont Blues in Virginia, North Carolina. And to this day, you can find people out in the country who are playing Blind Boy Fuller songs that they learned from their daddy, who learned it from their daddy.
I got a big bad woman, me shaking on a bone. I say, hey, hey, me shaking on a bone. And every time she shake, some man dollar come. Yeah.
If you tell people you're a folklorist, they think you're either, you know, going to play the banjo or tell stories. And unfortunately, most of us do play the banjo and tell stories, but or you know, old folk musicians from back in the 60s, you know, Kingston Trio. Chuck and Nan, that's how they got into folklore, singing the songs they learned growing up in the South. Chuck's father raised mules and I guess was a farmer in South Georgia or near Atlanta, I guess. And he learned from his mother a lot of the old ballads. So they were singing in coffee houses in Washington. And somebody said, you know, Chuck, this being a geologist stuff, which is what he was on the GI Bill. He was working as a geologist on the Army bases. And he said one day the missile went up and it came right back. Test missile came out and blew up the barracks next to where he was. So he said, I've had enough of being a geologist. Let's be folk singers, Nan. But somebody told him about the PhD program in folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. And he studied with Kenny Goldstein, who read my dissertation 20 years later, got a thorough grounding in folklore. He introduced me to a lot of the cutting-edge theory that was coming out in the 70s.
Stop a minute. You're talking about folklore as somebody who studied it and has a doctorate in it.
Right. It is.
Yeah. Yes. What is it?
Yeah. Folklore is, gosh, that's a long story. The word folklore wasn't even coined until the 1840s in England. And back before William Toms coined the term, it means the wisdom, lore of the people. Mm-hmm. In those days, it generally meant the peasantry. In England and in all over Europe, during the rise of nationalism, people were trying to identify their nation, their ethnic group, through the songs and stories. The Brothers Grimm were early folklorists. They collected German folktales. Turns out they were mostly French folktales. But they were philologists, and they were trying to trace the origins of modern languages back to the ancient Indo-European roots. That's called the geographic school, I think, historiographic school. But they were also trying to establish what it meant to be a German, you know. And in France, the same thing was going on. In Italy and in England, it went on with a vengeance. You know, the classical composers who were mining the folk traditions. Ray Vaughan Williams, the composer, was a big buddy of Cecil Sharp, the folk song collector. As a matter of fact, the Cecil Sharp House in England is the home of the English Folk Dance and Song Society. Their main archives is the Ray Vaughan Williams archives. Cecil Sharp would go out into the countryside amongst the peasantry and the working class blokes and collect all these old English and Scottish ballads, border ballads mostly. And Ray Vaughan Williams would take some of those tunes and make classical pieces out of them, same way Aaron Copland did with Charles Seeger's early collections of American folk music. Copland really created an American sound by using traditional folk music. Of course, the same thing was going on in Scandinavia, well, in Eastern Europe, a lot of the classical composers, but it was a way of identifying a national identity. What happened in the United States, the American Folklore Society was started in 1887. I think that's what it was.
I'm impressed that you can take a stab at the exact
I remember the centennial. That's how. So, and it was founded by Franz Boas, was the anthropologist who was considered the father of American anthropology. He was also one of the fathers of the American Folklore Society, started the same year as the American Anthropological Association. It was designed to collect the folklore, the traditional wisdom. At that time, it was very much antiquarian and kind of a rescue operation. They were trying to collect all of the old ballads, the English ballads,
it was kind of
Scottish ballads that were dying out.
Yeah, endangered culture.
And it's always been kind of chasing the dying out. That's what people think of when they think of folklore, is stuff that's old-fashioned. But we've learned over the generations that folklore never dies out. It's part of human communication. It's a basic need. It's all of the things that we learn at our mother's knee. It's stuff that we learn in groups that connect us to those groups, particularly the stuff that is informal. It's not taught necessarily with books and lesson plans. It's the kids' games that the kids teach each other on the playground, not the games that the teacher or the phys ed teacher teach you. You know, it's the games of catch and rhyming games that the little girls teach each other. They still do. Same darn rhyming games that were collected 150 years ago, you can collect on the playground today. Of course, now they've got Ronald McDonald and, you know, who else involved as characters, but Miss Mary Mac, all dressed in black, 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 with silver buttons, buttons all down her back, back. Includes everything. It includes games, dances, songs, the way we cook, recipes, family recipes.
Stories,
yes. I don't consider myself a storyteller, but I'm very big on the power of narrative to bring communities together, to create new communities, but also to strengthen the ties that bind within communities. There was a great article the other day in the New Yorker, I think, or New York Times, about the importance of building a family narrative. The families that are most healthy are families that know their history, emotionally healthy we're talking about, that have family stories, how we got here, the struggles we went through.
This is the not just the immediate family, but the ancestral family?
It can go back that far. It can go back just as far as
Mom and Dad.
When your mom and I met, and you remember the story we told you about your first tooth or whatever it was, and it's repeated over and over and over. So by the time the child grows to adulthood, he's got this network of stories that connect him to everybody else in the family, even if it's a very small family.
Yeah.
But those of us who are lucky to have extended families and have stories from those extended families are much more grounded in our culture. When I'm doing field work, and I've not been a professor of folklore. I have a doctorate in folklore, but I've mostly been working outside of academia to do field work, cultural surveys of specific regions, the Outer Banks, the Eastern Shore, the Southern Appalachian Mountains. I've done a lot of work in the mountains. You know, a four-county group in the upcountry of South Carolina, where they have a shared culture, you know, and shared history.
But let me ask you this. We left you sitting on the floor at Tandem School,
yeah,
listening to Mike Seeger's Merry Band.
Right.
And falling in love with the...
with the music.
With the music.
Which is really...
And then you're getting a PhD.
Right.
Which is pretty serious academic
study. When you first met
me,
you ran Martha's Restaurant,
yes,
on Elliewood Avenue, and I was teaching guitar lessons at the guitar shop two doors down. And my
those
wife, Sally, was working at the Pentagram Gallery. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
But... you know, when I first got out of school, there was a recession on, and I was tired of school, and I thought, well, maybe I can make a living here in Charlottesville as a musician.
What'd you major in?
I majored in folklore.
At UVA?
You can do a interdisciplinary major at UVA. You could in those days. They call it something else now. It was called a university major when I was there. And you basically build your own major. You find your advisors, and you write a thesis. So I had an undergraduate thesis on music on Ocracoke Island, which is where I used to hang out and a lot in the summers. I'm still in contact with the guys I did field work with, the ones who are still alive.
Did you hear the Old English there in Ocracoke?
The brogue, yes. Oh, God. I wish I could claim this in a big way, but I wrote about it in my undergraduate thesis, something that became a book later out of North Carolina State, I guess it was. Some linguists went and looked at what was going on Ocracoke. You know, it's not Elizabethan English the way the old historians and the tourism people write about. Same way, you know, Appalachia is not old Elizabethan English. It's a thriving contemporary language with its own quirks. You know, the brogue on Ocracoke, where they all talk like this, and the old-timers would say me instead of my, and poppy instead of papa, and me mommy and me poppy, and they say, fried rabbit is sure is good. That's fried rabbit. It sure is good. you know, in Ocracoke Brogue. But what the Ocockers were doing was, that's what a person who lives on Ocracoke is. The native folks are Ocockers. They had been isolated from the mainland for a long time. Up until the 50s, the only way you could get to the island was by mailboat. But within, say, two or three generations after World War II, two generations after World War II, there was the bridge and then the ferry system. So now you could drive to Ocracoke from wherever.
First time I remember driving there, it was desert survival, where you had to pull off if you met another car. I mean, like these metal things laid down.
Yeah. It was really...
And the ponies were wild.
The ponies were all over the place, hadn't penned them. The first generation to really leave the island in a big way, of course, was World War II, and the men primarily. Mm-hmm. And they came back speaking more standard mainland English. Gradually, the people on the island became sort of bilingual. They would, in their own, among themselves, they would speak Ococker Brogue. You know, it would get real heavy, and you could barely understand a word they were saying if you were from off the island. But they knew how to talk to off-islanders, mainlanders. And over time, it became a way of identifying as an Ococker. It was kind of an ethnic marker, right? So by the time I was doing my fieldwork, the young men, that is, they were young then, guys who were in their 20s and 30s in the 1970s, had kind of rebelled from the fact that their fathers had abandoned Ocracoke for different places. And they felt their identity, because of all these tourists who were coming on all the time, they felt their identity as Ococker somewhat threatened. So it became a real ethnic marker to use the brogue. And they discovered, these linguists did, that the young men who I was doing field work with, their brogue was stronger than their fathers. Interestingly enough, stronger than their wives. The women were still speaking proper English because that's what, you know, they were all upwardly mobile. And the way they sounded was more like you would sound in Tidewater, North Carolina. Still a little bit of an accent, but not as heavy as Ocockers. But the fishermen who were trying to revive the fishing industry there, and the musicians who were, you know, culturally connected and trying to establish an identity for what it meant to be Ocockers, and deciding what, you know, their generation's repertory was going to be. When they came together, if you weren't an Ococker, you could barely understand a word they said.
What you're listening to is a recording of Douglas Turner Day playing General Lee Surrender at the Shenandoah Blues Festival in Verona, May 8th, 2010.
Down in Tennessee, meanest old rattle that you ever see. Cause I'm a rattlesnake and daddy. I'm a rattlesnake and daddy. I'm a rattlesnake and daddy. Honey rattle all night long.
Doug Day singing Rattlesnake and Daddy. You know what I'm noticing? I keep asking you questions about yourself. And you keep, it's not that you don't answer them. You give me a sentence or two about yourself, and then you zoom off into folklore again.
Oh, well, it's...
Are you in love with this stuff?
Oh, God, yeah, I've been transfixed by it. And probably since I was a little kid, for God knows what reasons. But to me, the music that, when I was growing up, the music that was more authentic, that seemed like it came more from the heart, and meant more to the people who sang those songs and who listened to them. We were all looking for that stuff in the 60s, late 60s,
yes.
Early 70s.
We were.
For me, it was, you know, all these old songs on Folkways Records, which was not part of Smithsonian yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, real folk songs had real meaning, as opposed to the pop stuff and the overproduced popular music that you could hear anywhere. You really had to look out for the traditional music.
I didn't discover it until, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah.
No.
Kids these days, oh my God, you know, you really had to seek out Robert Johnson records when I was a kid. And, you know, I bought my records in the cutout bins at Lloyd's Rexall down on the quarter. It's where I got all my Lightnin' Hopkins records and that sort of thing. But nowadays, you can go online on YouTube and find any obscure blues player you've ever looked for. Luke Jordan, early Virginia blues man. Nobody knew who he was. Now you can go on YouTube.
You better stop your never hit woman for me, my meat. Drinking my wine. Spend all my money, you better stop your gal. Put some tickling under my chin. You're gonna run on some of these mornings, partners where you can't get in.
But I want to ask you about
the Veterans History Project,
because I know that's important.
It is important to me. I'm still very much involved with that. The first year I came into the Historical Society, I got them involved, got the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society involved in the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project.
Which is, in case anybody isn't familiar with it.
Yes, it's actually a program of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. What happened was, right after Saving Private Ryan came out, two or three important politicians who had veterans for parents.
This is the power of Tom Hanks, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Or Steven Spielberg,
Spielberg.
Out at the end saying, we lose 1,000 veterans a week or however many a day or whatever it is. Of course, we have millions of veterans in the United States. But it is true, we're losing, particularly the World War II vets. And at that time, when they first started, we still had World War I vets. So Congress, joint resolution, both houses unanimously authorized, that is, it was an unfunded mandate to the Library of Congress, you will interview every World War II veteran, and we're not going to give you any more money to do it. But it's a worthwhile cause, and the Library of Congress took it up. The American Folklife Center had been doing oral history interviews since before World War II, since the WPA.
They knew how to do it. But not veterans necessarily,
not
just
everybody,
general.
Everybody, yeah. General stuff. Before World War II, and I think at the tail end of the WPA era, it was still the archive of folk song, and that's what they were mostly collecting. But it soon, because of the Writers Project, they expanded to doing all sorts of other kinds of narratives. All of the ex-slave narratives of the WPA were done under the auspices of the Federal Writers Project. The special collections, the small library at UVA has, I believe, aluminum discs or cylinder recordings from the WPA of ex-slaves in Virginia.
Wow.
As well as recordings of folk songs that were done by professionals and literary types who were on the dole during the WPA, and the Federal Writers Project got them out there collecting stuff. So they had all this stuff going, and they decided to take on the Veterans History Project, but to expand it. And they knew they couldn't do it themselves. So it became a network across the country of like-minded organizations who could do oral history interviews. A lot of them already had war-related collections of interviews. There's a Vietnam women's veterans. They're all over the country, including ones that are done by the military themselves. And what they had to do was unite all these disparate collections into one giant veterans database while training volunteers to collect from not just World War II vets now, but Vietnam, Korea, Grenada, all the Gulf Wars, the Berlin Airlift, not just interviewing combat vets, but support troops, people who are working in wartime industries back on the home front. And some of the best stories that I've ever heard come from Vietnam nurses who were back in the boonies, at the front, knee-deep in mud and blood, and with shells raining around them, just amazing stories. So we got the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society to be an archiving member, which meant that the interviews that we organized and collected in Charlottesville actually stayed in Charlottesville at the Historical Society, and copies and all the paperwork were sent to the Library of Congress. Generally, the way the program is set up, and you can find the Veterans History Project at www.loc, for Library of Congress, .gov/veterans/vets. And you can download all the materials about the Veterans History Project and all the how-tos and the necessary forms. What's always required, my main mantra for doing oral histories the right way, aside from a good microphone and a good tape recorder and the ability to listen and shut up, are the release forms. Because if you collect an oral history and you don't get a release form from the person you collected it from, it's useless to scholars. may have some use to somebody, but I have seen oral history collections. I did a survey in the state of Mississippi for the whole state of folklore and oral history collections, and there were some wonderful collections of oral history that were done at, you know, small libraries at historical black colleges in the Delta of civil rights workers. And because it was organized by, you know, somebody who had no great heart, good intentions, but no experience, they got no release forms. So those histories can't be used in any written analytical materials or historical materials. So if you download this stuff from the Library of Congress or have them send you the hard copies, they'll send you everything you need to know. I've been working with the Library of Congress since 2002, doing training sessions. The American Folklore Society and the Oral History Association has a roster of folklorists around the country who will go and give training workshops to your organization for free. The Folklore Society will pay us to come and give a presentation on how to interview veterans, how to properly do the recordings, how to send the stuff to the Library of Congress. You know, it's both easier than it sounds and harder than it sounds. I've interviewed veterans who have never spoken about their war experiences to anybody in their family ever, ever, ever. But after the trade centers went down in 2001, these guys started coming out of the woodwork. Or their family members said, "Daddy, you've got to tell somebody. You know, if my grandchildren want to hear these stories, we've got to get them down on tape now."
I meant to ask you how to fix that car. I always meant to ask you about the war and what you saw across the bridge too far. Did it leave a scar? Or how you navigated wings of fire and steel up where heaven had no more secrets to conceal? And still if I